We play an ugly game.
I want winners. I want people that want to win.
When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. There is no middle ground.
You play to win the game. Hello? You play to win the game.
Welcome back to House of the Dragon 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm yours, Anthony. This week, we are re-airing a Double Dragon episode. Steve and I cover episode 1 of season 1. Many of the listeners of this podcast have not heard that, and so if you're doing a rewatch of season 1 of House of the Dragon, perhaps this can be your companion podcast. Later this week, Jim and Aaron will return to discuss some differences between the book content of Season 1 and the show content of Season 1. Finally, if you'd like to hear Steve and I cover crime drama, you can check out our podcast, Properly Howard. The season is titled Felonies and Fugazis, and we will begin by covering Point Break. All right, enjoy this previously aired episode of Double Dragon.
Peter Dinklage.
I know, we're just using the same Peter Dinklage song, even though there's no Peter D to be found.
They leaned into it. There were a few scenes where you kind of heard the music, right, to kind of get the old feel. But no introduction, no credit sequence to kind of get you in the mood.
Obviously with Game of Thrones, you're going, you know, the map, you're going all over. Mm-hmm. Here, I guess it would just be like going through like the different rooms.
Right, because this is basically just set in King's Landing. I mean, they did a few scenes in Harrenhal, but
yeah,
you don't see anyone on the road, you know?
Right, and I mean, I'm assuming we will.
Why would you need a road? You got these dragons to fly around on.
That's true. I mean, the dragon, I guess, is just like having a commuter lane everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Should double these things up, man. You guys are both going the same direction.
That's right. Dragon pool.
There's enough room on the back of that dragon for a few saddles.
Right. Yeah, totally. A dragon pool, dragon buses.
You'd think the show would capitalize on all the different ways you could use a dragon. We really have just touch the tip of the iceberg here.
I'm kind of hoping by the time you get to season like 3, there's just no human cast.
it's all dragons.
Just dragons.
It's all dragons. Do you think that there's someone like some rich, bored billionaire in Westeros that's eating like dragon egg omelets?
Oh, for sure. Just hoarding these dragon eggs. People are like doing people have to start doing the dragon pool. Is because the dragons become scarce because you just have, you know, you got your classic King's Landing 1%.
It's not going to be the Targaryens because they, you know, they want to raise the dragons, but there's got to be someone out there that just like.
You don't think there's at least one capitalist Targaryen who's just like, no, I mean, I deserve all the dragons.
He's got a black market, dragon egg market, where he's just selling these to different gourmands around the kingdom. Totally off the books.
Yeah, he's like, you know what? I'm trying to get healthier. Yes, I'm just doing dragon egg whites.
Shh, shh, shh. Don't say it so loud, man. Everyone's going to want one.
They got Beyond Dragon, Impossible Dragon.
Dragon beaters. South of the border style.
I can't believe it's not dragon. You sound a little raspy. Did you just go to a concert or something, or were you just up all night cheering now that there's new Game of Thrones content?
Mm-hmm. Just hooting. Just hooting. At every scene, I was hooting. I lectured all day long, so I kind of lost my voice.
Gotcha.
Kind of out of the habit of being in the classroom, so my voice is a little bit atrophied. But it brings a little gravel. Doesn't it sound a little bit sexy?
Yeah, so it kind of is going to give our listeners a sense of like, man, how long has it been since we've heard these guys? I mean, Anthony's aged quite a bit.
Yeah, no, yeah, I've taken up smoking.
Anthony's gone full Nolte.
I feel like we should talk about sort of the second...
The show?
Oh, yes, that.
We can do that now.
Okay.
No, let's just talk about the after party a little bit more. I think people want to hear more about our indulgences.
Do you feel... Let me start like this. You've watched this twice now, one on a big screen and one on a small screen, because I'm assuming you're watching this in a hotel room right now, right?
Yeah. Yeah, smaller screen.
So sure. You're in a hotel in Vegas and smaller screen. And so let me ask it this way. Did it feel like Game of Thrones?
Yeah, that's a great question. And now we'll be honest, like during the rewatch, I was kind of nodding off a little bit. Not that I wasn't interested or anything. I was just, lipping in a car all day and it's 1,000 degrees in Vegas. And so I'm, I might've had a little martini or two, So I was like, oh, so I wake up like, oh no, I missed that part. Yeah. But yeah, so that's different.
There's a dozen podcasts out there that's going to cover this show. But when you tune into Double Dragon, you're going to hear one of the hosts who actually fell asleep during the show. That's the level of coverage you're going to get from Double Dragon.
Yeah. I mean, the goal is to have an episode where neither of us watch it. And it's just us discussing what we think probably happened. Let us know, write in, tell us if we were right.
So did it feel like Game of Thrones?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it had the song, which makes it, I mean, not a lot of other shows do that. it's you got the throne, the Iron Throne. Seems like a pretty big deal. But I think what you're talking about is like, does it grip you? Is that what you're asking? Like, do I feel like I'm back in that universe again? But like I had the same reaction the second time as I did the first time, where I did feel like the first half I was like, oh no, my instinct when I first saw this was like the first half didn't quite move me. I mean, I was interested, but something I wasn't in.
Yeah.
And then the second half I was like, okay, now I'm in. And I'm watching it again, it validated that feeling. Sure. For me. So I would say the second half I felt like I was back. It was Game of Thrones, but the first half felt like, as my wife put it, you think they want to mention dragons a couple times?
Okay. It definitely felt like the darker elements of Game of Thrones.
Okay.
Like, if you think back to Game of Thrones, like, everything in King's Landing was like anyone could knife you at any moment. That's kind of how it felt.
Sure.
And everyone's got a knife behind their back, and everyone's kind of ambitious. And if you're naive, you're done. You're done. You're not gonna make it through.
It's the game. Everyone's right. Playing it.
Then every now and again, so you'd have that, but then you'd like cut away to the road, and you'd see two unlikely traveling companions, and they're kind of making fun of each other. Or you'd see, hey, that knight's a woman and she's really tall. Yeah. Isn't that kind of goofy? Or, you know,
that guy likes bread.
There's a guy that he's just really into baking, right? Or there's a goofy pirate. And I feel like that's the kind of stuff that I missed. I feel like there's an aspect of that series that I didn't find in this first episode. Not to say that I won't find it. I'm kind of looking forward to those elements as they introduce new characters. But I do feel like they really captured the darkness of the first series. And they gave me almost no levity.
Right. And that, in many ways, isn't that kind of... even more intriguing, because theoretically there's not a Game of Thrones to be played. I mean, there is internally, right? I mean, that's what we get, is that there's this internal family strife is really what we're going to be focused on.
No one can take down the Targaryens except for the Targaryens.
Right. So that's the question. It's like, well, will the Targaryens take themselves down? So that's definitely part of where we're headed. But you would think that if you're the cock of the walk, if you're living pretty large and you're you know, sitting on stables of dragons, wouldn't things be a little bit more upbeat?
Did you just say if you're the cock of the walk?
Yeah.
Is that a phrase? Is that a did you just introduce me to a new phrase that I've never heard before?
I've heard the phrase.
Oh, all right. I'm not familiar with this phrase.
It's someone who dominates others within a group.
I see. That's the cock of the walk.
That's the cock of the walk.
It's not like the chicken that I'm cooking up with my dumplings or anything.
It's not the cock and the walk.
Okay, good.
Which is also, it depends on how you want to define that, but either way, it's dangerous.
Okay. The other thing about this is I really thought that, you know, the original series love to play with these really old taboos like incest or patricide or cannibalism. You know, these are the kinds of things.
Those are old taboos, huh? We got no.
They're so old. They're so old that in the modern world, we kind of don't even worry about them anymore. You know, it's not oh no, that guy's going to eat me. There's not that part of our daily life, but they're so ingrained in the human experience. They exist in our psyche, like almost like an anthropological level, right?
We know they exist. So when we hear it, we're like, what? We don't go, are you kidding me? But we just go, oh, we heard. It's sort of like, I mean, it's sort of like when there's a polio outbreak, right?
Sure. Yeah. It's really like, primal.
I've not had to worry about polio. In fact, I was kind of banking on never having to worry about polio. Right. And now you're telling me I got to go pull out an almanac to figure out how to even deal with this?
Sure. So anyway, I thought that this show did the same thing for childbirth. It's like, It's this really dangerous human experience, but they told such a compelling story with it. I just thought that's what Game of Thrones did with all of these other primal dangers. This episode did that with sort of childbirth in just a horrific way. I mean, it was just, if you can watch that scene and not feel something, then there's something wrong with you. That scene was...
I know. No, you're right. And so watching that scene a second time was... I don't know how did you shy away from it at all? Did you immerse yourself back into it? I mean, it was a lot on the big screen. I'll tell you that the first time we saw it.
It was quite a bit. And I was in. I was all in. I was more interested in what was going on in the birthing bed than I was in the tournament.
Sure.
Which is,
well, the ramifications of it are huge, right? I mean, it's going to change. It changes the course of everything, even if you don't know how it's going to turn out. Because even if he gets the heir, then that sets a new path, mm-hmm. right? I mean, and if it doesn't, then that also sets, you know. So it's a crucial. It's like you could argue it is the moment, right? For this.
Well, he's got all his eggs in this basket. He's like, look, you guys worried about all these problems. You're worried about the kingdom coming apart at the seams. You just wait till my son's born. It'll solve everything. And so, and he really, he's bought into it. He's bought into this idea so much so that he's willing to sacrifice his wife in order to solve this problem.
Right.
And then, I don't know if you remember, but when we were in the theater, when they show her corpse and then they like, do a really long shot on the infant corpse on the pyre.
Uh-huh.
And I remember like everyone in the theater, like an audible gasp, like,
yeah,
that was really well. It was a good way to tell that story. I just think it was perfectly framed.
Yeah. I really liked that. I mean, I liked, you know, you get the inclination cause like the baby gives like a couple of odd calls.
Yeah, I noticed that the second time.
I noticed that the first time. So the first time I did notice that, and I was like, ooh. And because the maester did just a slight look like, huh.
When the camera's rolling, you're not supposed to cough. It means, and then like, cut to next scene.
That's right.
On the pyre.
It was a blooper, and they're like, well, we didn't have another take. Yeah, so it was a lot, right? I mean, it's a big deal. So, yeah, and I think from that moment is when it really starts to take off for me because I feel like the editing was a little bit different as the show moved on. And I don't know if that was a conscious thing, like maybe because there was so much of like trying to set things in motion.
What do you mean by editing?
It felt like the first half was just a little rushed. Like, you know, there was something about it that just I don't know if it was so much tone or pacing. Like, I think maybe more of a pacing thing for me that it seemed a little haphazard at times.
The first 10 minutes were I felt like we're just dull.
Yeah, I think that might be part of it. But
I was recently listening to an interview with Martin because, you know, he's done a lot of TV work. You know, he did Twilight Zone and Max Headroom and, you know, shows from the 80s. And so he's written for TV a lot, and he was sort of talking about the difference between writing for the page and writing for the screen. He's like, you know, the actors have to do a lot of the work for the writer, just with facial expressions. And then he kind of went off to the side and he's like, unless you're going to do some sort of like clumsy voiceover.
Yeah. Yeah.
As soon as this show started and with a voiceover, I just thought it was really funny.
Yeah. So I think maybe there's something to be said for that too. I think that did leave me a little bit like, okay. I mean, it obviously relies on it on the previous story, which of course would be the sequel, right? This is the prequel. So I think that's one of the things that maybe it's a hard thing to do with the prequel, is just let it be.
I think so. And I think that the one thing that kind of, if I had one bit of criticism for this episode, I kind of feel like you didn't need to bring in the White Walkers at the end here. Like don't connect it to the other series and maybe right. Don't connect it to the part that people were really dissatisfied in the previous series.
And someday there'll be King Bran.
So
what's a King Bran, Mama?
Would you rather have a voiceover, or would you rather have like a bit of dialogue on a character's lips that's clearly intended for the audience and not the other character in the scene? This is kind of a would you rather question.
Right. No, I definitely think that just trust your, it feels like you don't trust the audience, right? Like, we know what we're doing. Like, we know what we're getting into. And I would rather, if there's any question, like, well, how long ago was this and where does this tie in? I almost would like, so let's, we talked a little bit before in other podcasts about Better Call Saul, which I've now started watching. And to me, that's a great example of how a prequel can work. You know where it's headed at some point, and you live in that tension, but the show almost doesn't care.
Sure. Yeah.
Like, the show is like, well, we're gonna get there if we get there, and you decide if you want to go along this ride, because this ride, you know, and then because it does butt up against Breaking Bad, there is a sense of you start to do some of the work, some of the math to try to figure out how this is, and so that's the extra enjoyment that you get, but the show doesn't need it to be great.
Yeah.
And so with this, you have this 172 year time gap. So if there was ever a time to really just be like, look, just we want to go into another world, we want to go back to this universe at a different time, let us trust you to do the work and give us a compelling story with compelling characters without having to wink and nod. And I don't think of these were like true winks and nods per se, but they certainly weren't nothing, right?
Right. I mean, some of them were a little bit more subtle than the other ones. You know, it didn't ruin anything for me, but I did think, like, I don't know. Did you need it? I don't think you needed it. I feel like a show that was totally confident and totally secure in itself wouldn't have to bend over backwards to kind of connect it to something I know that I already care about, you know?
Right. And you do wonder, though, sometimes, like, how much of that is directors and writers versus maybe the studio.
Right. Yeah, that's right. That's a good point. It was sort of bookended, right? Yeah, you kind of had the thing at the beginning, the voiceover at the beginning.
Right.
That kind of connects us to Daenerys.
Right. And has to really connect it to the point where, like, let's just take all the other words out. 172 years before the thing you liked.
Let's highlight it, underscore.
Yeah.
Circle it, make sure that you saw it.
All the letters come rolling at you in 3D with the
and then at the very end you had you know, the king passing down by word of mouth the ancient legend of the Song of Ice and Fire. So I don't know. I mean, it's fine. I don't have to complain about that kind of stuff.
But it does set a concern. This is the first foot forward, right? I mean, this is what it is. This is your first impression, and I'm like, are we going to run into more of this? Is this sort of just necessary to do maybe in the first, you know, the pilot to kind of get people back on board? You know, so for some people that might have been helpful.
Well, guess, and
right? Like, okay, we're back.
If I was going to be gracious, if I was going to be generous, I would be like, these guys took on a project that where the previous series ended pretty badly.
Sure.
You know, public reception, right? I mean, you famously loved the last episode of Game of Thrones, but a lot of people did not. So these showrunners are taking over this franchise, and they know that maybe there's a little bit of ill will. Maybe they're going to go to the extra effort to kind of remind us of the things that we loved about the first.
Right. And there's a bit of a prove it factor too, right? I mean, I'll just keep talking about Better Call Saul and the Breaking Bad, because I think it is, because it is rare that you get a beloved show that then comes up with a prequel, right? I mean, there's spinoffs, but a prequel is a whole different animal. And so one of the reasons why I did not go to Better Call Saul for so long was because Breaking Bad, as we've talked about, was an amazing show, if not perfect.
Yeah, it was almost perfect. So why mess with anything that's perfect, right?
Right. So the idea of reentering that universe seems like, I don't want anything to, like, if it doesn't work, then is that going to change how I view Breaking Bad? And in the Better Call Saul case, I mean, I don't know that it could have, but I mean, it certainly was a possibility, right? I mean, especially if it starts overlapping, and you know, is it going to create any questions? Is there some inconsistencies? Things like that could just start taking, it could just bring it down a notch. This one has an advantage in terms of being 172 years prior. So you're not butting up against anything. You're not going to see, the droids from one in the other.
Jesse Pinkman selling drugs to R2-D2.
Right. Yeah. A baby Jesse Pinkman.
Baby Jesse Pinkman carrying around Chewbacca.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Because he got him outside of a grocery store and a box of free Wookiees. So there could be some trepidation. So the other side of that is, well, you better hit this one out of the park. You know what I mean? When it comes to a pilot, like, I better be, to your first question, I better feel like I'm in Game of Thrones.
I think that even more so than Better Call Saul, it's like, if this season isn't a home run, it's a failure. I think that there is a sense of that. It's like, this is living in both sort of a massive shadow of a previous success, but also a massive shadow of a previous failure.
Right. It's wild.
It's kind of nuts. And so it's sort of like, if this isn't perfect, people are going to turn on you really fast. Whereas sort of Better Call Saul, I kind of felt like, I'll give it a few seasons. I'm kind of enjoying this guy goofing around Albuquerque.
This can do that too, and in many ways it feels like a little bit smaller scale in terms of who's manipulating each other, as opposed to, you know, lands versus land. I mean, who knows, we may see some more of that down the road, at least in terms of threat, but ultimately the biggest threat is within the family.
I think that this show introduced significantly fewer characters. It was almost like everyone that's important can fit in one room. Whereas the previous series, it was sort of like, you got to travel all over the kingdom and over to Essos to figure out who these key players are. And every single one of these doesn't know anyone else. So you're going to have to sort of start their story from scratch. And so this,
that scope creates another like sort of dichotomy of expectations, sort of what we talked about too, because on one hand you go, okay, well, if there's less characters, then you should really be able to flesh these out. And, one of the critiques was like, there's so many characters to keep track of in Game of Thrones that, you know, are any of them getting short shrift? Whereas this one, it's like, okay, well, you should be able to do that, right? So then now your expectation level goes like, okay, good, you've maybe baked in something that makes it a little bit easier to do this character development and move the narrative along at the same time. But on the flip side of that, it also adds that, okay, so you've given yourself a smaller scope with which to work, you have less excuses to screw up, right? I mean, so like the you must nail it factor seems pretty high, and I think it's going to be a sustainable one unless it just absolutely keeps us entranced.
Okay, I want to talk Daemon Targaryen. I kind of feel like Like, almost instantly, I'm watching a really important character in the history of television. And it's a lot to put on, like, one episode. But I do feel like when he was introduced, I couldn't take my eyes off him.
Sure.
I feel like I'm witnessing the birth of something important.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a lot about Daemon Targaryen. And I want to do it by introducing, by talking about four different scenes. I think that these four scenes introduce something, some different nuance of his character. So the first I'm calling Naked Ambition. We walk into the throne room and he's sitting on the Iron Throne. And I was just thinking, like, how many times have we been in that throne room?
Mm-hmm.
How many times over the course of, you know, the last 10, 15 years do we see a scene in that throne room? And for some reason, when they walk in, the way that they light that room and the way that they shoot that scene, it's just masterful. I feel like they're making that set seem interesting in a way that I hadn't seen it before. The guy that's with Rhaenyra is basically like shocked and appalled that he would even be on the throne. And right. So anyway, this is why I'm calling this Naked Ambition, because he basically, you know, he's talking about how, you know, he's the heir and, you know, he's going to be sitting there one day or whatever. I want to ask,
and the throne still maintains that it's like it behaves as a character, right? I mean, I think right. that we talked about that in the rewatch. It's remarable how without moving or anything, it feels anthropomorphized, right? Just by virtue of existence.
Absolutely. And it'll cut a fool, you know? And it's like,
oh yeah.
It works as a metaphor. It works on a number of levels. I wanted to ask you about this scene because I think it's a really important introduction and it's using subtitles. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to kind of get your take on this. Like, I think sometimes subtitles will enhance a scene and sometimes it's sort of like you could have done this all in the common tongue. So mm-hmm. did using High Valyrian enhance the scene for you?
I think so. And I think it does for a couple of reasons. I think it shows, I think it's important to introduce High Valyrian in this world. It would make sense that it would exist. It brought to me a certain layer of seductiveness between uncle and niece, mm-hmm. which I think is important. I think because there's something about the way that they were speaking to each other there. It suggested they have a relationship where this has happened, right? This is something. This is
it's a shorthand for intimacy, right?
Yeah, this is how they communicate with each other, and they've been doing it like without having to give any backstory or anything. I've already like, well, these people know each other intimately, and there's an exclusivity to it as well, right? I mean, mm-hmm. so that it's and that's how I think, you know, great intimacy works, right? Like, you're not allowed in, kind of a thing, right? So it felt chilling, it felt seductive, it felt it made it more sinister in a way that without having to do much of anything, right? So I think it really was a great way to introduce him, and I think it's a great way to sort of set a tone of that relationship.
Right. I thought I and that's the other thing I wanted to say about this scene is that those two characters are kind of mirror images of each other in a way, because what we just found out about her is that she does not care about the sacred at all, right? Mm-hmm. There's a previous scene where she's ripping the page out of a book, and you, oh no, what about the septa? F the septa. You know, that's the whole, you know, she just doesn't care about the sacred. She's sacrilegious, and then when she walks in, seeing the ultimate sacrilege, you know, here's someone who's not the king sitting on the Iron Throne. Mm. She's a little bit amused by it. She's a little bit like, yeah, that's my favorite uncle.
Well, and he's not hiding. Yeah. And he's not hiding how he feels about it either. Right. So there's a trust level there that says, I can be a little naughty.
Exactly. So they're kind of, they have a sacrilegious, like his sacrilege is mirroring her sacrilege. I thought that really worked well.
And the idea too, that like going forward, that are they going to be rivals? Mm-hmm. Or because they're Targaryens, are they going to be something else?
Yeah, are they going to be lovers, right? I think that that's all in that scene. It's like there's all kinds of possibility for these two, right? So, okay, that was the first scene that I'm sort of titling Naked Ambition. All right, so then there's the sort of the openly defiant. This is sort of him at the tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the tournament could have easily been pretty boring. You know, they were talking about like the after the scenes. They were talking about like, we wanted to bring action into the first scene. You know, that's great. You know, we want to see action. But it's sort of boring unless there's political intrigue attached. And everything that Damon does, every choice he makes is a total act of defiance to Otto Hightower, right? He chooses his son. He's, I'm going to unhorse your son in front of all these people. I'm going to embarrass you. And then what does he do after that? He asks for the favor of Hightower's daughter, right? So every single choice he's making is like a little jab to Hightower. And so I liked that scene told me something about him and something about their relationship, more than just sort of being like eye candy.
And it's out in the open too. We get the sense so we had that throne room scene where he sort of plays his hand to some degree with the, you know, with the niece, and you're like, okay, that makes sense. And then it's like, oh, but when he's out in the open, like, diplomacy is not his thing. And he calls his shots right out the gate, and not just like in the room with, you know, not like it's just with the council, like, no, this is for everyone to see. Yeah. I mean, she's showing Hightower up almost above all else.
Yeah, it doesn't matter whether he's in the brothel or in the tournament or, you know, in the throne room or whatever. This is the guy who's going to speak his mind without any kind of, you know, concern for the consequences. So, you know, that told me something. The other thing I was going to mention about that scene was that, so I'm friendly with someone who's sort of an expert on medieval warfare and an expert on these ancient tournaments. And so I asked him, like, hey, so if you sort of try to trip the other guy's horse instead of trying to unseat the guy, mm-hmm. would that be considered illegal? And the answer that I got was, it depends on the context, but it's absolutely dirty. You know, it's totally, it would be a total dirty move. And it would sort of be synonymous with Italians. That was pretty good.
Wow.
It's like, it's a dirty move, and you kind of expect it of Italians. So I thought that was nice. Speaking as an Italian, I'm thinking, yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, and speaking as somebody who's, you know, disgusted by Italians, I also agree.
And then, of course, in some contexts, it would absolutely be illegal. So I just thought that tells us something about him, too. Like, he's willing to play dirty to win. Again, these scenes are not just for eye candy. They're absolutely telling a political story, which I appreciated.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's great.
Next thing I want to talk about, and this is a fascinating scene for me. Okay. I'm calling this the insecurity scene. All right. So he's in the brothel, and I'm really bored of HBO's nudity. Like, I'm just kind of over it. I'm like, this isn't scandalizing anyone. This is all kind of boring.
Right.
But in the second time I watched the scene, I realized
you were just thinking about who was doing the sound effects. Like, what were they using? Guys just got two pieces of prosciutto they slapped them together. These are things that I think about, I guess.
Again, grotesque Italians doing grotesque Italian things.
Yeah. I just walked by the deli, and I was like, hey.
I thought it was interesting. I don't think I caught it the first time. This guy who's like established as sort of the badass of the series, he's kind of vulnerable to ED. Mm. He's got a little erectile dysfunction happening. Is that how you read that scene?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the second time around, it seemed like that might have been the case.
I just thought that was a fast, like, in a show that sort of like you just expect the nudity, so it's kind of boring. I thought, oh, this is interesting. this brings a level of complexity to a character that I was not expecting. And it brings a level of vulnerability to this person. And then after that, he kind of like retreats to this little bench or whatever. And he wraps himself in a sheet and he allows himself to be consoled by his paramour, Masaria. And so then the question is this guy insecure? Because I think that that's what that scene is trying to tell me. He's kind of insecure.
Yeah, no, I think so. And I think that this is the Daemon Targaryen show, right? I mean, at least that's what it's
at least this first episode. Like. I mean, look, Rhaenyra is really interesting, and I'd love to see the sea snake, you know, do swashbuckle and stuff. But this first episode is absolutely Daemon Targaryen show, right?
Yeah, I mean, and I think nothing works without the thing with Game of Thrones is that, you know, who's bad, who's good. That's always seems to be a little blurred. And so in this case, it's like, I think they've added some complexity to Daemon, but it feels like it'll be hard to root for. He's the J.R. Ewing, maybe, of this whole thing.
Sure. All right. Here's what I want to say about this. The fact that he is insecure, I think, makes him more dangerous than anything else, right? It's like, this guy has political ambition. This guy has a weapon of mass destruction that he rides around as a pet, right? But what he's got a fancy sword. But what makes him dangerous is that he's got all that and he's insecure. I think that we saw that over and over and over again with certain characters in Game of Thrones. And I thought, oh, they could have gone a different direction with this. But by making him insecure, that kind of makes him, it brings an instability to his character, right?
Right. Yeah. And so then what the motivations may be, maybe less cut and dry, right? Like if it's mm-hmm. just, oh, well, you know, because I mean, pursuit of power is nothing new in these types of shows. But the motivation for the power is where you can get creative. And that's where, like you said, I like the way you put it there, the idea of insecurity breeding a level of instability that makes it even harder to know. Like he's harder to trust even as a character, right? Like to trust what the character is going to do next.
He's not purely logic.
We get the opportunity to see, because we get to see all these scenes, whereas not everybody else gets these glimpses. And so we have this sort of, you know, omniscient sort of look at it, right? And instead it's, you know, I'm not sure what I know exactly. The more I know, maybe the less comfortable I feel about, you know, what to expect.
Because if he's insecure, he's not like a total Vulcan in the sense that like he's just pure logic. Like he will act out of desperation. Like there, you could imagine a scenario where he sort of acts out his insecurity in a way that might do political damage to himself or others. I just feel like to bring that level of vulnerability and security to that character makes him even more interesting.
Mm.
All right, final scene that I want to talk about with Daemon Targaryen.
Go on.
Okay, I'm calling this sort of the empathetic scene. All right, so there's this little scene at the funeral. When Rhaenyra kind of hesitates, comes up to her and he's super gentle and he says,
"They're waiting for you."
And it just is that is this very minor note that he's got empathy for her. And she's sort of, again, they're kind of mirrors of each other. She's experienced all of this complexity of emotion. Her mother just died. She, you know, she can kind of put words to the fact that, you know, my father was only happy for one day, which says something about her. You know, she was never able to bring him true happiness. And I get the sense that that emotional complexity is something he understands. So just that little moment of empathy says something about both of those characters.
Sort of bookends our introduction to them to this, where it's like, okay, so where, you know, their relationship is again rife with history. It's complex. It appears that they have a genuineness, right? A genuine history with each other and a genuine affection and relationship with each other that will only add to the complication of the political intrigue that is inevitable between their stations.
Right. So I thought that's a really smart thing to do. You want to introduce two new characters, make them reflect each other, and it'll bring some texture to the scenes that they're both in. Is there anything more about this episode that you wanted to mention that you noticed that you thought was intriguing?
Well, I mean, I think this is probably fairly obvious for many, but just I really like the idea of this world with the Targaryens with dragons. That's the reason why the Targaryens matter, right? I mean, dragons are pretty important. I know dragons are mentioned a lot, as my wife mentioned. It was like, dragon? A little bit of a dragon over here. You know how it is, riding dragons all day. You
smell like dragon. Sounds like, you smell like dragon.
I got dragon elbow. You know how it is, you're trying to control. Yeah. So you know how it is, dragon ass. You know how it is. But dragons are important. You know, I mean, like, because without them, the Targaryens are just, silver-haired weirdos. So I mean, and they mention that, right? They talk about that. They talk about that. You know, without dragons, you know, we're essentially just everybody else. So they're in this position of power because of this relationship with this creature, and what I love about that, though, with that, where they feel like, well, nothing could possibly, you know, tear this asunder when you've got this kind of control. It's sort of like, you know, when you've got the atom bomb, then nobody else does, then, you know, the threat, right? It's like that kind of Cold War concept. But then but then when you're isolated in that position of power, right, there's still power to be taken, and that's where we see the crumbling of this particular family, and the power dynamic can be at risk if there's no peace. You know, if it's one thing to try to maintain peace with the biggest weapon, but then you have to make sure that all the stewards of these weapons are also peaceful.
Yeah, it's like this concept that power invites challenge. This is sort of back to the Joker Batman problem. It's sort of like, look, if you show me that you're superhuman, then there's always going to be someone out there that's like, I could do that better. You know, right. I'd like to try my hand at that. I don't think you know. And so it's kind of fascinating to have a Targaryen who's sort of like, you know, we never should have tinkered with dragon magic. Like it was a bad idea from the beginning. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Like our podcast is named Double Dragon. I don't know if you remember in the video game Double Dragon, you would, if you both played together, you would fight together, but you could hurt each other.
Oh yeah, you could accidentally hurt the guy, right?
You could punch him, you could throw the knife at him, and then there were times where I'd be playing with somebody at Scandia, and they would just haul off and just start beating the crap out of me. And then it became like it became Street Fighter. Sure. If anybody was wondering why we named it the Double Dragon, it's because of that subtle.
No, I'm glad that you brought that up. So yeah, that is absolutely why we named this Double Dragon, because of that odd feature.
Mm-hmm.
In the NES game Double Dragon, and of course that eventually by the end of this series you and I will have to fight.
Oh yeah, it's going to be pretty brutal, or we'll have to have some sort of incestuous relationship to keep with the theme.
Or both.
Well, that's the hope, right? That's what we're all hope. That's the one thing that's keeping people onto the show, right? The hope of both.
All right, so just to remind people of our rating system, the best you can get is a Dinklage. And then sort of a garden variety episode, we're calling a Danny, which is actually good because garden variety Game of Thrones is really good. And then of course, if it's underwhelming, this is a Dorne. So I think, Steve, you're on the record for saying, that this show was properly Danny. Do you want to change your rating?
Yeah, I was on record that this was properly Danny, and I stand by it. Cause I think like I said, the first half was a little more disjointed for me, or it took me a while to get back into it again.
Well, and you fell asleep.
And yeah, well, sure. But I did still like it. I think the positives outweigh any of my quibbles. And again, I mean, this isn't like the first time you watched first episode of Game of Thrones, because this is, you know, this, like you said, it's got a shadow, it's got a burden, mm-hmm. that it has to go. Mm-hmm. So, and if the thought is they better nail it, well, then you're going to look for every reason why they didn't.
All right. So I'm on the record for saying this is a Danny plus two. I'm going to say Danny plus three on rewatch.
Okay.
And the reason why is that there was just all these levels of complexity to Daemon Targaryen that I didn't catch the first time.
Got it.
And of course, Danny plus three. I'm close to Dinklage rage at that point.
Yeah. That's low Dinklage.
Yeah, I'm not gonna say it's a Dinklage minus one, but I'm saying we're in the Dinklage.
It's not out of the conversation for you.
It's not out of the conversation. I thought that this introduction to Daemon Targaryen was magnificent.
So Daemon was the rising tide for you.
I think so. Absolutely. Okay. Finally, dismemberment count. We had a number of dismemberments. We had two hands got dismembered. That was unfortunate. One very notable castration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then one beheading.
Yeah. I think that was a notable castration.
All right. The other thing that we're doing is we are going to predict what happens next episode, specifically in terms of bare butt cheeks.
Yeah, right?
This is cheek speak. We're going to do the cheek speak over under. It can't just be sort of an extra who happens to be naked. The person has to have dialogue in the show and reveal a butt cheek. That would be one. A full moon is going to be two cheeks. So, Steve, character with dialogue and bare cheeks, what is your over under?
I'm setting it at four.
All right, so you're at a four. So if this show has four or higher, you will be correct.
Right.
All right, interesting. Okay. I'm gonna take the under on that.
Okay.
I feel like first episode, they sort of want to catch at eyeballs. Next episode, there'll be a little bit less brothel scenes.
Okay. Right. I see. Now, I don't think that, and you know, these don't have to be sexual cheeks.
No, it just could be, you know, some guy who's
tub cheeks.
Wants to air it out. He just wants to air it out.
It could be funny cheeks. Maybe it's silly cheeks. Maybe they're watching a little play. Maybe the jester comes out and, oh no, look at me, bam, and everybody's like, ah.
All right. So this is titled The Cheek Speak Over Under. Now, the one caveat here is we would also allow cheeks that have dialogue in the scene.
Right, if the butt talks.
If the butt talks, then that would also. Now, this last episode, there was actually a flatulence.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would count.
So the person never speaks, but the butt says at least something.
Yeah, that's right.
All right.
It counts. All right. So on the record, you're saying four or over.
Yes.
For cheek speak. And I'm going to take the under on this.
Yeah.
So a side cheek would just be a one, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Side cheek is one. You'd need the full moon.
I mean, basically any crack gets you two.
I'm glad we have set the ground rules here.
All right. I don't want you to write in if you think that these are too complicated and you need us to write it down for you.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
So I'm with a real life doctor of medieval literature, Natalie Goodison. She's at Durham University, a place very close to my heart. She's the author of Introducing the Medieval Swan. That's University of Wales Press, but of course you can get that on Amazon.com. And Natalie, that book is pretty accessible.
Yes, it is. It's written for anybody interested in what medieval perceptions of swans were like, but it also has a thorough glossing of footnotes. So for the undergraduate or postgraduate student who's interested in the sources, it's a good place to look.
I think my listeners will want to know, what are the pictures like?
There are lots of pictures. If you flip the book, the swan flies in the bottom right hand corner.
Oh, there you go. Fun. Sold. Sold.
My favorite picture is I have one of the queen attending the swan upping. So I was really pleased with that. But I do have a thorough glossing of British Library, Huntington Library, pictures of swans. So it's probably maybe 20 pictures. So I love my pictures.
So I was given your name by a friend named Jana Matthews. I emailed Jana and I said, look, I need someone who's an expert on the birthing bed. And Jana said, well, I do like this person. And she sent me a link to the Durham faculty webpage. And I was thinking, I've been to Durham before. I know that that's a good place to go. And so anyway, I'm curious to hear in this first episode of Game of Thrones, there is a harrowing scene depicting sort of a medieval attempt at a C-section. And I thought it would be great to have someone on just to talk about some of the dangers of the birthing bed in the medieval period. So what can you tell us about that?
Well, I'm very flattered to your friend, Jenna, for introducing me to you. That's wonderful. As far as the medieval birthing bed and cesarean sections, academically, the coolest person to go to is Monica Green. I'm in the cover of her book, Making Women's Medicine Masculine, shows a picture of a cesarean section in the Middle Ages. And what it has is it has a woman on it who, the picture is a woman who is dead. And you can see that she's exposed, so she can see her breasts. And there's a man, a kind of cleric in the background with a tonsure, and he has a book and he's directing kind of where to cut and how to open it. And what's really fascinating is that what they're pulling out doesn't look like a baby to me, but it looks like a lump of flesh. And one of the things that I've written on quite a bit is about how a very rare genetic abnormality that women can give birth to, it's extremely rare, is something called a hydatidiformal, which is a lump of flesh.
Oh, say that word again.
It's called hydatidiform mole.
Okay.
It's also called like a uterine mole. That might be a more common phrase.
So I'm kind of curious, so this would be sort of an aberration, but I'm kind of curious, like, what would the birthing bed be like?
Of course, they shifted as the Middle Ages went on, but you would generally, a woman would be surrounded by a woman, and she'd be surrounded by a midwife, and then midwife's helpers. So these could be family, these could be wet nurses, but generally a kind of bevy of women who were familiar and intimate with what was happening. And so it wasn't their first rodeo. And I like that idea of just being surrounded by a lot of women you knew and the local midwife. You would have probably been likely in your own bedchamber, especially if you were wealthy.
Sure. And this would have been even the case for queens. Like, it would have been preferred that the women attend the queen and not like some, you know, male scientist, you know, from the local monastery or something.
Yeah, well, sometimes the men did come, but it was, and that's kind of the whole point of Monica Green's book about making women's medicine masculine. For the beginning, it used to be a lot of women. Over the Middle Ages, you generally had more male involvement as you went on. But one of the interesting things that often women would employ, and I've written on this, is that they would employ a birthing girdle around their waist. And the birthing girdle could be made of iron, it could be made of silk. But the one that I've seen
is made of... I'm sorry, did you say iron?
Yeah, so think of like Robin Hood Men in Tights iron, that's what I'm thinking of. So I have a source in the Middle Ages that said the birthing girdle made of iron. Okay.
Okay, all right. Sorry to interrupt you.
No. So the one I've seen is made of parchment, and it is written with all these kind of ritualistic talismans that are in kind of Christian heritage. So they had like crosses on it with the blood of Jesus and the nails that pierced his head. And you can tell that these things have been kissed. And you also can tell that they've been wrapped around women's bodies. And one of the things that me and my biologist colleague proved is that it has traces of cervical fluid on it. So it has the idea that especially wealthier women who could afford to rent these out for monasteries would probably have worn them around their bodies to kind of invoke any kind of aid, supernatural aid.
Okay, yeah, so, yeah, absolutely. So this is sort of bringing in a little bit of hocus pocus to the whole affair. But was there actual physiological aid to the girdle, or was it all just superstition?
I mean, it's hard to say, right? So most of it was probably mental, right? So you sure. Go into a highly stressful situation. All of a sudden, you're wrapped with a talisman that has been blessed by the bishop and has, you know, calls upon 15 saints. That you are now suddenly protected from Satan and his army kind of hurting you and your baby.
And it has a psychological effect because now you're a little bit more relaxed, right?
I think that's it. I think that's, I mean, of course, how do we know? But that's my best guess, is that that would probably have had quite good psychological effects on these
women. Interesting.
Knowing that that had been employed before successfully, knowing that you were calling upon divine help.
Right. And I guess if you have any rough ballpark numbers of like maternity mortality, things like that, I'm curious to know like what was the expectations going into the birthing bin?
So it's such a good question. And the answer to that is, of course, complex and difficult to answer in some ways, because at the heart of it is it's really difficult to say, because when you're thinking about death and mortality rates, there isn't the record keeping that we have nowadays. You did get it by the kind of higher Middle Ages, you know, maybe even, I know Germany had it at least in the 14th century. But a rough guess, and Carol Rawcliffe, she is great, but she says that it's probably about 30 to 60% would die in the birthing chamber. Like, you had a lot to fear. So you have loads of complications that go into just pregnancy and stuff. And this is medieval and modern. It is sort of same over the time.
Yeah.
You can develop gestational diabetes, which is diabetes that only happens when you're pregnant. You can develop, you know, conditions for blood clots, where all of a sudden your body is forming these blood clots in your throat, and you know, you could die from basically having your body not clearing those. There are things like eclampsia, kind of the famous case in Downton Abbey where she died of eclampsia. So that happens often. So even just before you kind of go into the birthing room, there's lots of dangers. Yeah. And then in the birthing room themselves, there are so many. I mean, any parent who's taken a birthing course, I think you kind of get inundated in all the things that could possibly go wrong.
Yeah.
So all the things that could possibly go wrong are quite, you know, even just a breech birth is quite huge. You know, the fact that you might not dilate quickly or fast enough.
Yeah. And if it was breech, I mean, were they adept at turning the baby? I'm curious if it was sort of like, oh, it's breech, this is done. We are not going to be able to make this happen.
No, they do have medieval diagrams for how to turn breech babies.
Okay.
It is difficult. It would have been difficult and much more painful than I think we've experienced it now. Let's just say you had the most kind of ideal delivery possible. You know, that even if you kind of gave birth kind of quickly and swiftly and fine, there's still one of the things that you have, especially in England, is you have kind of infectious disease risk, and you're just incredibly vulnerable, A, after you've given birth, and B, as a young human, as an infant. So with the kind of plague ravaging England around the 13th century, you get even a kind of higher risk of infant mortality rate and a higher kind of susceptibility for the mother. So with all those things combined, 30 to 60% sounds about right, if I'm kind of thinking about it.
Okay. All right. So, all right, let's imagine, so you're in a situation where it's like, I've got to choose between the mother and the child. Do we have literature that talks about folks who have to decide between the mother and the child?
Generally, it would have been you save the woman. The woman has a higher chance of surviving than the baby does.
Okay.
So in those situations, you weren't likely, like Macbeth, to kind of tackle a cesarean. You might tackle a cesarean if the woman was already dead. But even then, I think that was quite abnormal.
Okay.
I don't think it would have been very normal for a cesarean to happen. They did happen. There are wonderful papers describing cesareans happening. Okay. But I think that they were not the normal way to go, and it's mostly for the risk of infection. How deep do you cut? And just if you think about the scar that's on the woman's belly, just that recovering and stitching time, it would have been very, very difficult. Generally, you save the mom.
I absolutely appreciate your insight into this, and I'm sure my listeners will appreciate it too. And again, I just want to mention introducing the medieval swan.
Well, interestingly, the book has a picture of a mother who just gave birth to septuplets in it. So she's in the birthing
bed,
and you can see all seven babies on the side.
Oh my.
So there you go. That links to your questions about women.
Wow. Okay. Natalie, thank you so much for your time.
No, not at all. Thank you so much.
Okay, here's an excerpt of my conversation with Dr. Ian McInnes. All right, I'm going to ask this question. This is from Brian.
Brian writes, in fantasy, we see all sorts of ways that dead bodies are disposed of. We see boats sent out and set aflame. We see bodies burned on pyres. Or like the gravedigger in Game of Thrones, we see them buried. Were bodies fed to livestock or set out for the crows? What was the common means of disposing of the dead? And did it really depend on location during the time?
Yes, I think in medieval Europe, the norm was indeed for burial. And there were different rituals regarding preparation of the body for burial and indeed for the burial service itself. Obviously, for more important people, there was more in the way of ritual and spectacle surrounding such things. So kings, for example, had quite spectacular burial ceremonies with the body being carried sometimes over long distances so the people could see its procession before it reached its final resting place. Kings also had quite detailed plans laid out for their funeral service, as well as for the designs of their tombs. And nobles and knights, too, went into quite a lot of detail about what they wanted to look like in death and the design of the effigies, which were often used to sit on top of their tomb, to project an image of them in death, essentially portraying to the world how they wished to be seen and how they wished to be remembered. Obviously, though, there are times when the normalities of death were made more difficult. So battles, for example, would have produced large numbers of dead. Nobles and knights' bodies were often found and rescued from the battlefield. Usually they were identified by their armor and by the heraldic symbols they wore on them. And they were often taken back home for burial. And various English knights and even Henry V of England were preserved and transported back across the channel for burial back in England. Yeah. But on other occasions, this might have taken place wherever was nearest to where they died. So some English knights killed in Scotland were buried there. King James IV of Scotland is killed in England at the Battle of Flodden, and he's buried in London eventually, although his body kicks around England for quite some time before he's buried.
What about just like the local farmer who he got caught up in the battle and he beat his plow into a weapon and he went off to fight? Like, what would happen to his body?
Yeah, I think that the mass of the infantry are probably going to end up in mass graves. And we found a couple, historians, archaeologists have found a couple. So the Battle of Towton in the 15th century, there's a mass grave been found near there. Or the Battle of Visby in Gotland, there's a mass grave found there as well. And the Visby army was mostly peasant warriors. So yes, they were essentially buried near to where they fell. And there was less ritual and less, I don't know, there was no fancy burial for them.
Right, sure.
I mean, they just back to the question, though, the other example of how people are treated in the circumstances, a nice example is how traitors were treated. And, of course, you have treasonous people who are, in England in particular, who are executed by multiple deaths. You know, they're drawn by horses, they're to the site of the execution, they're hanged until not quite dead. They're beheaded, that the bodies are chopped up. And so you have someone like William Wallace, whose body is cut into pieces and bits of his body are sent around for public display in various castles in Scotland and Northern England. His head is preserved so that it can be stuck on a pike outside the Tower of London so that people can stare at it for years after the event. And so, yes, traitors, by and large, I don't think received any sort of burial, or if they did, it was after a prolonged period of time.
I think this is tied in some way to belief about the resurrection. I mean, if you think about the way that, just the difference in the way that pharaohs were mummified, they were buried in a way that would prepare them for the afterlife. And they would have provisions, you know, they'd have a boat and they'd have, you know, they'd have honey and things to eat and whatnot. But I think that there's something about Christendom that, and the belief that, you know, the body will be raised, which makes burial optimal. And then, of course, if someone like William Wallace is not buried and he's actually pieced apart, I think that that is some kind of deterrent for his entry into the other world or something. Or am I thinking about that incorrectly?
No, I think that may well be part of it. I mean, the idea of that idea of kind of multiple deaths and things, and indeed even just abuse of the corpse, as does happen increasingly as the Middle Ages goes on, or in particular examples anyway, you know, is that means of multiple punishments. But yes, I think you're probably right to see that also being reflected beyond, you know, beyond death, and indeed in terms of the afterlife. That yes, if you can do anything to potentially deny access to the afterlife for a traitor, then that wouldn't necessarily be seen as the wrong thing. I mean, although at the same time, medieval kings would also sometimes have themselves buried in multiple locations. You would have the deliberate, you know, the burying of the body in one place and then the burying of their entrails somewhere else, the burying perhaps of their heart in a different location. The idea being that in those multiple occasions, you ensure that there were even more prayers said for your soul and thus to speed its passage to the afterlife.
The papacy
frowned on that, and really, I think from the late 13th or the 14th century, banned multiple burials, banned the body being split like that, but King still did it anyway. So I suppose it's yeah, you can probably see the two different sides to that idea.
The dogs really like being this high up, just watching things.
I guess if you are a dog, you're always trying to get to that highest point, aren't you?
Yeah, the dogs is not right now. Laddie's just growling at a person parking their truck at a parking garage.
Would you be up for a segment on feedback?
Right now?
Yeah.
Sure.
So, Steve, we got some iTunes feedback. People have rated and reviewed us on iTunes, and we appreciate this. This helps us.
Yeah, it's good.
It's good. Yeah, it's good. Justin, he's taken us up, Steve, on our recommendation that they could just write a review for any show on our podcast review.
Oh, okay. Wonderful.
Joe Rogan's podcast is just dumb dorm room philosophy soaked in Red Bull and pretty and petty masculinity. I wouldn't know. I don't listen to Rogan, but I'm glad that you wrote this here, Justin, because I'm sure that people will be interested to know what our fans think of Joe Rogan's show.
Right. See, yes, if there's any crossover.